one fool to do your dirty work. Oh yeah, I don't wanna do your dirty work no more.
I didn't start out to be a singer, and I ended up being the lead singer of Steely Dan by accident, really, when we just couldn't find someone who could convey the proper attitude that Walter and I envisioned. And, you know, I toured for 2 years with the band as a frontman, but it was too stressful for me.
You know, I spent... the better part of a decade of my life working on those records and songs, and I'm glad that it's held up, you know, stylistically, and is still appealing to people. You know, that I'm glad that it's held up better than some of the clothes I was wearing at that time.
Are you reeling in the years?
Hi, I'm Walter Becker.
Hi, I'm Donald Fagen in the studio for Steely Dan's "Can't Buy a Thrill."
There has always been something mysterious about the music of Steely Dan. The music they made was exotic and distant, different somehow than the rest of what was on the radio at the time. Pop music before Steely Dan came along had never been quite this edgy. It had never been quite this cool. What added to the mystery was the fact that Steely Dan was never really a band, not in the traditional sense anyway. Oh, there were musicians, all right, wonderful musicians, like Jeff Skunk Baxter and Elliot Randall and Denny Dias. Over the years, though, the musicians would change, but the heart of Steely Dan, the shadowy figures who created it all, remained constant. They continued to weave their strange musical tapestries into some of the most critically acclaimed and popular albums of the 1970s. Their names? Walter Becker and Donald Fagen. They were the ones who brought Steely Dan to life. They never meant to be pop stars, and in most ways, they never were. The guys in Steely Dan didn't like to tour. They didn't like to pose for photos. They didn't like to do interviews like this. To this day, Donald Fagen doesn't really like the sound of his singing voice. Walter Becker and Donald Fagen met in the mid-60s as students at Bard College in upstate New York. Becker remembers that Fagen had wasted no time in claiming the musical high ground around campus.
When I got there, Donald had already been there for 2 years, and he had this band, obviously had the good band and all of the gigs that there were for the band on the campus. So I told him that I wanted to play the bass in his band, and he said, well, gee, I've already got a bass player. And that was that. And then at some point subsequent to that, he heard me playing the guitar, and he had three guitar players in his band at that time, and none of them were really any good. So we got a new band together, and I was the guitar player, and we started writing shortly after that.
Donald Fagen of Steely Dan.
By that time, I had a couple bands with personnel that dropped in and out, and I was looking for a good guitar player. I heard him practicing in this kind of campus club, and he was, you know, I heard the first thing before I saw Walter, I heard him playing from outside the club, and I thought it was, you know, some kind of authentic blues person, because it was very, just the technique that he was using, and the sound was really great sounding and really authentic sounding. And then I went in this club, and there was this white kid with blonde hair playing the guitar, and a red Epiphone guitar, actually. The reason he sounded so authentic is he had learned from another kid called Randy California, who had a couple bands in the 60s, and he was a neighbor in Queens. And Randy, in turn, had learned from real blues people, because his father had been in blues bands for a long time. So actually, Walter is in some sort of line of authentic blues players. You know, we immediately got along very well. We had a lot of things in common. We were both jazz fans who had also become interested in blues and the rock and roll, and had a similar sense of humor. So, you know, we really hit it off right from the beginning.
Do It Again, the first single from Can't Buy a Thrill, released in October 1972, contains an electric sitar solo from Steely Dan's Denny Dias. In 1969, Donald Fagen and Walter Becker left Bard College for the active music scene in New York City, hoping to make it as pop songwriters. And it was there that they first befriended Gary Katz, who would become their trusted producer. It was Katz who, in November 1971, got them a gig. There was just one catch, though. The gig was 3,000 miles west in Los Angeles. First, Donald Fagen, followed by Walter Becker.
The reason we were out in L.A. is that we got a job out in L.A. with ABC, what was then ABC Records, as staff songwriters, and we got the band together out there. So
they gave us a little office, and we were supposed to write songs that some of the other artists on the label could do. And as it turned out, the songs that we wrote, none of them were really very suitable for. They had, at that time, they had the Grassroots and Tommy Rowe and Hamilton, Joe Frank and Reynolds. And, you know, Donald and I weren't very good at writing songs for other people, especially for those people. So we tried to write some songs, you know, that would be of interest to those people, and they weren't. So we decided that we had better just continue along, you know, with what we had in mind, which was doing our own record featuring our own bizarre songs.
And I think that the fact that we were, you know, exiled from New York to Los Angeles, you know, I think it did provide a lot of material for a song, for the songs, and also a general sort of a psychological ambiance. You know, Salvador Dali used to talk about a method. He had a painting where he would, before he painted a picture, he would have to get himself into this ultra paranoid state.
It heightened our, you know, our delusions, our persecution delusions to a, you know, a new all-time high.
Times are hard. You're afraid to pay the fee, so you find yourself somebody the job for free. When you need a bit of loving, 'cause your man is out of town, that's the time you get me running, and you know I'll be around. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh yeah. I don't wanna do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh yeah. Light the candle, put the lock upon the door. You have sent the maid home early, like a thousand times before. Light the castle in its corner. In a medieval game, I foresee terrible trouble, and I stay here just the same. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh yeah. I don't wanna do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh
yeah. Dirty Work, written by Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, appears on the debut Steely Dan album Can't Buy a Thrill, sung by David Palmer. This album was full of smart, clever lyrics over melodies and arrangements which were not quite pop, not quite rock and roll, not quite jazz, but a tasty concoction with elements of all three. Here's Steely Dan guitarist, songwriter Walter Becker.
Jazz had kind of dead-ended in a kind of modal improvisation style that was not really that interesting to me or to Donald. In fact, most of the fire and creative energy that had once been invested in jazz music was now in pop music, and pop music seemed like the direction to go into both of us. So we were aware of the fact that although, you know, jazz was a wonderful kind of music, it wasn't necessarily of any interest to anybody else at that time. So the things that we tried to do were primarily, influenced by blues and the pop music scene in general as it existed at that time. The name was kind of borrowed from a dildo that was in the book Naked Lunch by William Burroughs, and we were stuck for a name, and we had used this particular name before in a song that we had written a long time before. And now we had, we had a steel guitar player in the band, and it seemed like a good name to us at the time. And in fact, it turned out, you know, it had a certain zing to it and helped the band be popular in the beginning, I think.
Even original Steely Dan drummer Jim Hodder took a lead vocal on the irresistible Midnight Cruiser, which featured a memorable guitar solo from Jeff Skunk Baxter. When Donald Fagen and Walter Becker return in a moment, you'll find out why the all-important lead singer slot was such a revolving door on Can't Buy a Thrill. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear even more rare Steely Dan music and interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Donald Fagen and Walter Becker in the studio for the anniversary of Steely Dan's debut, Can't Buy a Thrill.
Hi, I'm Walter Becker.
Hi, I'm Donald Fagen in the studio for Steely Dan's Can't Buy a Thrill.
Here with Redbeard.
As noted earlier, there were several lead vocalists on Can't Buy a Thrill, including David Palmer, who was brought in midway through recording. The reason was that even though Walter Becker and Donald Fagen had written all of the songs, Donald was reluctant as a lead singer, not at all comfortable in that role then. I asked him how the band felt about it.
Well, I think they were they had a conflict about it. On one hand, because Walter and I wrote them and knew what they were about and understood the attitude that was best to convey them, they realized that I could do that. On the other hand, I didn't have had a very small range and really hardly any experience, and they sort of looked at it two ways. On one hand, they wanted somebody with a bigger voice, you know, who could kind of thrilling rock and roll vocalist. But on the other hand, I think everyone knew that we just weren't going to find anybody who could convey the attitude, which was really the most important thing. So I didn't start out to be a singer, and I ended up being the lead singer of Steely Dan by accident, really, when we just couldn't find someone who could convey the proper attitude that Walter and I envisioned. You know, I toured for 2 years with the band as a frontman, but it was too stressful for me. It was like I just, I'm basically a composer, and I enjoy playing a lot. But singing is like, you know, to me makes it a job in a way, and because it's not as easy for me to do as to play, and it doesn't flow as easily. So they you know wanted me to do it, and there was some pressure. And finally, after Dave Palmer did a few tracks, which he did quite well, it wasn't really representative of what the thing was all about. So finally, Dave left, and I was elected.
money and I spend a lot of time. The trip we made to Hollywood is etched upon my mind. After all the things we've done and seen, you find another man. The things you think are useless, I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years? Stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years? Stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine?
Electrifying guitar solos by session monster Elliot Randall all over the song Reelin' in the Years on Steely Dan's debut Can't Buy a Thrill. Guitarist co-writer Walter Becker weighs in on the early Steely Dan quarterback controversy.
I guess now it can be told. David Palmer left. It was obvious at the time to us that the real sound of the band was Donald's vocals. Moreover, David's live performance style was kind of at odds with what we were trying to project as a musical entity. And so there was just an amicable parting of the ways at that point. You know, it had been kind of an afterthought that David joined the band mainly for purposes of live performance, and it just didn't really pan out that well.
The overarching impression one gets now listening to this Steely Dan debut by this totally unknown band is how focused and full-term this baby band was on delivery. Here's Donald Fagen.
We were very, very arrogant teenagers. We were in our 20s, but we still were basically teenagers. And we always felt that we would one of our things would hit. We were extremely confident, and although we it was very exciting, I think we probably downplayed it among ourselves in a way, because for one thing, we figured it would be just a one hit deal, and it was so we sort of said, well, it's a hit, but a lot of people have these one hit records, and so what? And there was also something frightening about beforehand we were just kind of we were having a lot of fun playing, and all of a sudden there's all this pressure, you start rehearsing more and trying to make it really tight, and it was kind of there's a lot of pressure on me too, because all of a sudden I realized that, well, there's the sort of a point of no return where now I'm the lead singer of a rock and roll band, and is this really what I want to do? It was both very exciting and also frightening at the same time. The whole pop scene had been changing while we were rehearsing this band and making a record, and by 72 or 73, it had really become something unfamiliar to us. There was at that time there was a lot of spectacle beginning to start in rock and roll, and we'd end up opening for bands who had very high shoes. A lot of British bands with very high shoes, and also some a lot of Texas blues bands and things like that. And I think for us, having come out of jazz and also the sort of New York Bleecker Street folk scene, folk rock scenes, the whole sort of visual part of touring was really not something we were that familiar with. And because we used to go see jazz in clubs and jazz musicians, especially in the 50s, really, although they had their own kind of show business, it wasn't regular show business and didn't have that much spectacle aside from the spectacle of musicians playing and their personalities and so on. And so when all this started happening, we because we weren't really that kind of into that kind of performance, it seemed very strange. And also the audiences started being a different kind of audience than we were used to. We were touring in mid-America and in the South, and people basically wanted to have a party, and we got a lot of Let's Boogie and the whole type. And also we were touring with originally we were opening for a lot of heavy metal bands and that kind of thing. Those bands always tour. They always need opening acts. So we did a lot of those. And even though the audiences really liked it, generally speaking, it was a very strange scene after a while. I think we felt alienated from the whole thing.
I realize that everybody's crazy. A woman's voice reminds me to serve and not to speak. Am I myself or just another freak? You know there's fire in the hole and nothing left to burn. I'd love to run out now. There's no way left to turn, no, no. With a cough, I shake it off and walk around my yellow stride. Should I hide or eat my pride or wait until it's good and ripe? My life is boiling over, it's happened once before. I wish someone would open up the door. Don't you know there's fire in the hole and nothing left to burn? I'd love to run out now. There's no way left to turn.
Fire in the Hole features Donald Fagen's impressive jazz piano chops plus the pedal steel guitar of Jeff Skunk Baxter. Still to come, Fagen and Walter Becker follow up the Steely Dan debut, Can't Buy a Thrill, which clocks in at an impressive number 238 on Rolling Stone magazine's top 500 albums of all time list, with an even more adventurous second release. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, and for more tasty Steely Dan interviews and live performances, be sure to visit inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Donald Fagen and Walter Becker in the studio of Steely Dan's debut, Can't Buy a Thrill.
Hi, I'm Walter Becker.
Hi, I'm Donald Fagen in the studio for Steely Dan's Can't Buy a Thrill.
Here with Redbeard.
It's a pleasure, gentlemen. By the second Steely Dan album, A Countdown to Ecstasy, kind of a cloak of mystery seemed to shroud the band. I mean, who were these guys that had just scored a number 17 seller with their first attempt, notching a top 6 single with Do It Again and a number 11 hit with Reelin' in the Years? And how did they get this good without showing up earlier on somebody's radar? Here's first singer-songwriter Donald Fagen, followed by guitarist-songwriter Walter Becker of Steely Dan.
Well, you know, if you read, you know, the music media, you know, there started to be this sort of thing about this mystique. I really think it really had to do with the fact that we stopped touring, and no one would ever see us. And yet we'd continue to put out records that sold well. So, that was about it, really.
Your countenance never appeared on any Steely Dan album covers, on the fronts anyway. And
there's a good reason for that.
And why is that, guys?
I can't remember. Some critic once early on when we first started playing said, you know, it's with the ugliest band they'd ever seen.
How do you think Steely Dan would fare breaking into the business in this video era?
No chance.
Not a chance in hell.
Nah.
One of the few criticisms that ever stuck was that you were maybe too clever, too lyrically coy. This was in the late 70s. But, you know, in my lengthy conversations, particularly with Walter, I've always heard really sincere humility. What devices do you employ to kind of keep each other grounded?
Sincere humility is the one I use the most.
In what way are you using the word grounded?
Electrically.
Electrically. Well, there's lightning rods on the ends of our glasses.
Donald has a alligator clip, which goes from his...
You know what it is? It's those three prongs. You got to have a third prong.
That's the third prong, exactly.
Guess what my next question was? How about humor? Your collective sense...
No place for it.
No place for it. You're too serious, right?
We have a serious message to deliver, and we can't jeopardize our ability to deliver that with some silly jokes.
Thank you.
What a band workout on the song My Old School, with vocal and piano by Donald Fagen, Walter Becker on bass, plus Denny Dias and Jeff Skunk Baxter climbing the necks of their lead guitars. It appears on the sophomore Steely Dan release A Countdown to Ecstasy in 1973. The entire Steely Dan catalog has been remastered and reissued in the last decade, which accounts for these recordings sounding remarkable after four decades. Here's Walter Becker with Donald Fagen.
Evidently, some of the, what happened was there, you know, there, you always have digital and analog copies of everything you do in storage, you know, and archivally stored. And when it came time to run off a new set of Steely Dan pressings, evidently, I guess that's mostly the responsibility of, like, the janitorial staff over at the record company.
It's not too far. That's so, not too far yeah. from the
Gus,
the truth.
The custodial engineer, inadvertently picked up the...
Yeah, see, they wanted a recording engineer, but they got the custodial.
Custodial engineer, and he picked up the analog copy, mm-hmm. That the one that said, do not use for mastering all over it, and he sent that down to the mastering house, and so for a while there were some... less than optimum Steely Dan CDs out there. But I think those have all been recalled and ritually destroyed in the correct, you know.
We had a big bonfire.
We melted them down yeah. into a...
Ever try putting a CD in a microwave oven?
No, I haven't
try
tried
it
that yet.
Mm. It's a thrill.
Donald.
That's where the real superiority of digital starts to show itself, because you could never fit a phonograph record
into a microwave. Bada boom. Walter Becker does turn serious long enough to assess the lasting legacy left by Can't Buy a Thrill and its 1970s siblings.
You know, I spent the better part of a decade of my life working on those records and songs, and I'm glad that it's held up, you know, stylistically and is still appealing to people 20 years later. You know, that I'm glad that it's held up better than some of the clothes I was wearing at that time or my haircut. So I think that that's rewarding. And it's also nice to think that there are enduring values in things, you know, that will make them continue to be of interest, even at a time when the styles are very different, and that it's possible to, you know, tap into those values and make something that will last.
Singing this song when Lonnie came in.
Steely Dan's The Boston Rag. It comes from 1973's A Countdown to Ecstasy.